Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody here with us this week. We got a great show coming up for you with some excellent guests, some return guests, some folks we haven't even heard from in a little while, so that'll be fun. But of course, before we get to anybody else, I have to always introduce, first and foremost, the amazing, the wonderful Sam Bradley.
Oh, gee, Jamie, I think I'm blushing. I'm glad I'm not on video. Good grief. Well, we haven't talked for a bit because you've been busy running around the world, whatever you've been doing, and it's good to kind of reconnect again. Of course, as far as the listeners are concerned, you won't see that break, but we did have a little bit of one. And unfortunately, Dr. Joe can't be here with us tonight. He's a busy guy and had a conflict come up, but we have three other guests that are wonderful. They're all return guests. A couple of them been on with us a couple times. We got our good friend BJ down in New Orleans. Hey, BJ.
Hello, everybody.
He's worked EMS down there for like 140 years, so we always
give or take two or three.
Get his perspective on things. And then we got our friend Kevin Ryder, our wilderness instructor down in Texas. Hey, Kev.
Howdy, y'all.
And we're going to be talking tonight with, he's really from New Jersey. Don't let that fool you.
How you doing? And
then, yeah, exactly. Well, that's what's so funny about BJ, too, is he still sounds like he's from the East Coast. And then we have our good friend who is from the East Coast, Steve Canarian. We talked to him some time ago about his experience at Ground Zero, and that's what's brought us together as friends, and his book, which we'll talk about. And tonight we're going to talk a bit about a blog article he wrote that I thought was really timely. So, hi, Steve.
Hi, Sam. How you doing? It's nice to talk to you guys.
It's great to have you back on. And I heard it's even hot in Baltimore, Jamie. I guess all of you guys
It's August. It's August in Maryland. It's hot. It's just the way it is.
It's 80 degrees and cloudy in Colorado. I'm good.
Yeah, sorry, but I'll be in short pants come Christmas, Sam. You, on the other hand, will not.
That's fine.
I don't know. I've been in shorts and T-shirts in Colorado on Christmas Day, so you never know in Colorado.
You're just weird, Kevin. So, right. Anyway, Jamie, what's up in the weather this week?
Well, Tropical Storm Earl eventually became Hurricane Earl and then kind of swept across the southern Gulf of Mexico and into Mexico itself. Where it caused a lot of damage, primarily due to saturated hillsides and rain coming down in the form of mudslides. And that was, killed 40 people, injured others. The death toll was still unconfirmed completely because, of course, as we've talked about before when talking about mudslides in the past here on the show, it takes a significant amount of time to identify and find everybody who's been missing once the recovery efforts begin, especially when you're talking about, villages and places with less contact and technology and things like that. People may be presumed missing who are not actually missing, or we may not know who actually was in any of these buildings that were consumed by the mudslides. So it's risky stuff.
Yeah, we don't always think of mudslides as being the worst case scenario, but the ones we've had have been really ugly. And like you said, if it's in the wrong place, it can really take out a lot of buildings, and people tend to be very unprepared for them.
Yeah, it's an issue, and it presents a unique search and rescue challenge for responders. So it's one of those things that we really need to just be aware of. Again, I bring up these weather related stories or disaster related stories when they come across in the news because I want people to really be aware of the conditions in their location, in their area. And that may even be when you're vacationing. So, if you're traveling somewhere and you're in an area, it makes sense for you to understand the weather patterns where you are. Kevin, you went from New Jersey to Texas and you saw, I'm sure, a huge difference in, the types of things you needed to be aware of where you are.
Oh, definitely. I mean, no more hurricanes like I had in New Jersey, but a lot more heat illnesses and getting sitting on cactuses or cacti related injuries and so forth, and a lot more venomous snakes.
Don't you get tornadoes down there? Are you subject to?
Well, we do. Luckily, not so much in my area, but we do get tornadoes.
Hmm. You just never know. So, hasn't the East Coast been taking kind of a weather hit in general lately with all the storms that have been out in the ocean?
Yeah, well, we had some of the flooding, some severe flooding early in August, or actually, I think right actually. When I was away on vacation in late July, an area that doesn't flood very often, called Ellicott City in just outside of Baltimore, Maryland, and they actually have flooded before, but the last time I remember them flooding this bad, I was a small child. It was Hurricane Agnes, which some of you may take you back a ways. Hurricane Agnes came up and hit the Chesapeake Bay pretty hard area, and there was severe flooding. And the center of town in Ellicott City was essentially underwater. So this happened again when it dumped, I think close to 6, 7, 8 inches of rain in the space of an hour. It just flooded the Patapsco River, which runs right through there, and it came up over its banks very quickly.
Wow, that's pretty scary. Well, in the way that is crazy as the weather is these days, you never know. You know, it's, going back to Katrina, everybody thought this won't be a worst case scenario, and it was. So,
well, and so here's the thing, right in the center of town, there's actually a plaque about the Hurricane Agnes flood, and marks the high water mark on this on this statue with this plaque. And so, if you see something like that in a town you move to, take note of it. Okay, it's not saying you got to move away, but take note of it and say, okay, it may have been 50 years ago, but that means that every 50 to 100 years there's probably a major flood in this area. So be aware of that, be prepared, understand the risks, and it's not safe anywhere completely. So, and you can't go about your life, wrapping yourself in bubble wrap. So it really is just being aware and taking proper steps to be prepared so that if something were to happen, you're in the best possible position to withstand the effects.
I like that bubble wrap. And I think, we've talked about this a number of times, but wherever you are, and even if you think I'm in a pretty good place right now, but something can always happen. We've had floods here. Always have a go kit. Always have survival material, which, make sure you have extra medications and eyeglasses and things that are critical, that you have extra things that you can put in that kit so you can just grab and go. So it doesn't matter where you are. That's just kind of a basic consideration. Kevin,
Don't forget the toilet paper. People typically forget about that.
That's
one.
That's the first thing that goes into my kit. Are you kidding me?
You'd be surprised how many people think of everything else, including the kitchen sink, and they forget the toilet paper.
If you've been to as many austere places as I have, which you probably have, toilet paper is the first thing in there. But, yeah, thanks for mentioning that. It's a good point. So anything else going on, Jamie?
No, I think that's it. Let's jump into our topic, because I'm really excited to hear what Steve had to talk about in his blog post, and we can kind of hit some of the high points and get right into that.
Yeah, I have a few points I want to make, because I think you make several good ones. Steve Kanarian is someone I met, God, Steve, I can't even remember how many years ago it was, but, we found some synergy in the fact that we were both veterans of Ground Zero, although he was there at the time, that day, as a lieutenant working in EMS and was also on the USAR. He subsequently wrote a book called The Downwind Walk, and you guys know what that means, a USAR paramedic's experiences after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001. He also has a site called Paramedic Mastery. He does a lot of paramedic education, and he has this blog that when I saw this and took a look at it, I said, we really got to talk about this, because Jamie, how many times have we talked about all of the active shooter situations? I mean, as many as we cover and think, okay, well, maybe we won't have one like that for a while. Here it is again and again and again. And now, and this one really specifies the shooting in Dallas recently and the focus on police. And Steve told me that the day he posted this, there was a shooting of police also in San Diego. So his perspective on this is, how do we as EMS people, and he approaches it, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but he approaches it from the perspective of, you're sitting in your ambulance, you know, hearing about cops being killed. So first of all, that tip puts you in a whole different mindset. Whenever you're dealing with other public safety personnel being involved, that puts your stress level at a whole different place. And really, and these guys are sitting in their ambulance thinking, okay, they're wanting to shoot cops. Maybe they have reason to shoot cops, but does that make us the bad guys or the good guys? What kind of peril are we actually in? And you make several good points, and I want to touch on those. But Steve, one of the first thing you commented on here, and I really like this, was a quote from a guy named Montrell Jackson, who was a slain police officer in Baton Rouge, whose comment was, "Hate takes too much energy." I love that. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, I've learned when I write an article, I don't worry about the title, and the title of this was kind of difficult to come up with. And when I was finishing the article, there was that shooting in Baton Rouge Police Department, where I believe three policemen were killed. And I was reading this guy's quote, this officer's quote, and he was on Facebook saying how he's disappointed with some of his partners and friends. And he says, you know, what's in your heart's in your heart. I can't change that. But, you know, you need a hug. I'm here for you. Hate takes too much energy. So I didn't really think that was a good title, but I thought it was nice to kind of put his words at the beginning of the article, you know.
And do you remember the circumstances? Do you remember the circumstances under which he was killed?
Yeah. He was three policemen that were shot and killed in Baton Rouge. It was just a couple of weeks ago.
What kind of an event were they working?
I don't remember.
I can comment. This is BJ. I can comment.
Yeah, bet BJ. I figured you'd probably know because it's down in your part of the world.
Yeah, there's still some mixed information, whether it was a straight-out ambush or just someone with a grudge, but 911 call came in for a man with a rifle. Units arrived on the scene, and they were all gunned down by a guy with a rifle standing on the street when the units came up.
Oh, man.
So you had multiple officers shot, the three officers killed. It was one of the bloodiest days in Louisiana I think I've ever heard about or read about.
I can't even imagine being a cop right now. I really can't. I mean, you know, life is tough for anybody that does what we do, but to have that extra fear of not knowing if you're walking into an ambush because somebody's pissed off about something, it's scary. And this is kind of weird. Go ahead, Steve.
I've been talking to different people lately, some policemen and some. I actually spoke to a Vietnam veteran who lived in a very difficult area in Connecticut, and they all had some interesting things to say. I've been agonizing this over a couple of months. I mean, I've had policemen who are friends. My wife's an ex-police officer, and she used to always say, you know, whenever you're a cop, you have a target on your back. But to me, in the 80s, if you were out going to a shoot, you know, a robbery, you'd expect a shooting. But to kill policemen and you know, without warning, this is really ridiculous. So one of the officers, I think what it is with the officers is some see it as, you know, it's not here. Others see it as, you know, it's an opportunity to do better. And my real concern was I was an EMS lieutenant for a long time. I worked in the streets, and I always try to focus the people. And I was thinking back, like, what it must be like now to be riding around the Bronx and Manhattan, or really any city in the country. I was talking to a lieutenant up in Manhattan, and he said some people are really scared. Others are wearing their vests, and some are taking it in stride. But I think it's one thing to go to a job where there's a crime in progress and expects a shooting. I think it's a total another thing to be shot at without warning. And that was the impetus of writing this article. And one of the officers in Massachusetts I spoke to, he says, you know, people have to be taught to respect the law, and there's ways to challenge the law and change the laws, but they're not a gunpoint in the street. And there was a veteran in Connecticut I spoke to. I walked into typical Steve Canary moment. I walk into a deli to get some food, and I end up spending 3 hours talking to this gentleman about a lot of things. And he says, there's nothing new about having automatic weapons in the United States. And I was shocked to hear that right outside of New Haven, you can get an AK-47. I was shocked in Connecticut. But what he said is, his thought was, he says, it's only been 50 years since the 60s and civil rights. And he feels that the government, our democracy is being tested this summer. And I think that these incidents that are happening, they're going to shape the world we live in somehow. I don't know what the effect will be, but this is very profound, you know, to be shooting policemen without warning.
Well, and the thing is, you made me, and this thought ran through my head as you're talking, you don't know what they're responding to. They could be responding to an incident that happened in another state or somewhere else in the world that, you know, the locals are upset about. So you don't know. It may not even be anything local that you might kind of expect a response to, but this could be a response to something totally unrelated. So that makes it even more dangerous. Right. And that's the next point. Go ahead.
Officers Juan Jen Liu and Rafael Ramos were killed on December 20th, 2014. And that was to avenge the death of Eric Garner and Michael Bra. I think Eric Garner ended up being killed in Baltimore. He fled New York City and was killed, I believe it was in Baltimore. So these guys were staffing a terrorism drill. You know, this is
really
just ridiculous. They weren't even on an assignment. They were, and the gentleman in the offices in Dallas, they were staffing a, you know, we're trained a high-risk incident or location would be like a mosque or a temple or a post office. I guess a civil rights demonstration really should be considered a high-risk terrorist type of location, you know?
It can be. And this is the point you make, and I want the rest of them to comment on this. So you two guys are sitting in the ambulance thinking about this and going, how do we go into the streets and provide care when they're killing police officers without warning? And then they refer back to the Dallas incident. And you say, how do we as EMTs and paramedics go out into the streets when violence can erupt in a gun flash, killing police officers without provocation? What do you think about that, BJ? I'm sure you guys have your incidents down there in New Orleans.
No doubt. And I've sat on both sides of the badge, having worked as a policeman for many years and have still being a paramedic. And we all know how we say, oh, we can't go on the scenes until after scenes have been secured. We've gone through all of this. The emotional decisions that you have to make with this, when this is the brother officers that you've had coffee with, the guys that you joke around with when you see them on the streets and when you hear things that go on with them, you just can't help but want to jump in and be involved as quickly as you can, putting yourself in harm's way in the process. It's such a difficult situation to deal with because they're put out there and they're in these situations where they have little or no control over how things go down, and you get thrust right into that craziness with them.
But at least in this day and age, and that's something I want to touch on with Jamie later on, is at least we know these things happen. We know that we want to go in there and get to these cops before they bleed out in an incident. And that's why we have the training that we have these days. And I think that's critically important because it's no EMS isn't going to be sitting in the cold zone for 20 minutes while, you know, people are dying in the middle of an incident. Now we have training. We've learned to work with the cops to get in there and to manage this incident before, you know, while we still have a chance of saving people. Kevin, what are your thoughts on this?
Exactly what BJ said. And going back, I think it was a few weeks ago on Twitter, somebody, I forget what movement they were with, mentioned something about, well, the firefighters or the EMTs are on the side of the police, shoot them too.
Jeez.
So, and I may or may not whatever your feelings on this particular subject are, because of where I go with my job, we go down to the border with Mexico. So at any one given moment, I may or may not be carrying a firearm concealed, just in case.
Yeah, I see your point.
That's for me and my partner. We're not looking to, you know, go around the countryside righting wrongs. That's for protection for me and my partner.
Yeah, that would be an interesting subject in and of itself to discuss someday. Jamie, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I really think that it challenges us to see what's going to happen. I mean, I think of the Dallas shooting. You know, the police were outgunned there for a good amount of time until they had that individual backed up into a location where they could contain him somewhat. And so, it really, we can talk about rushing in and providing some level of care early in these situations. But the fact of the matter is that we can't do that until there is some level of security in the situation. I mean, I'm not suggesting we stage a block away until it's completely safe, but we also it's difficult to expect an EMS crew to go in where gunfire is being exchanged actively without
Jamie,
any
I think
protection.
I think you're completely on target with that, and I'm a broken record. Every time I'm on, I'll say the same thing. This goes back to how we prepare ahead of time. What is our relationship with our law enforcement officers that we deal with, the different groups? Have we sat down and talked to them about how we're going to deal with the situations? What kind of training have we been in, such as active shooter training, in a good integrated method, not just some desktop run-through, so that we know what is going to be the best way to handle these situations? Because we all know once things go sideways, that's not the time to be making decisions. We need to have made those in advance.
Or doing it for the first time. And, you know, that's another point Steve makes in this article, is we're working a lot closer with police. I mean, when I started, you know, cops and EMTs and medics were all on a different page. You know, we worked together when we needed to, but they did what they did, and we did what we did, and it wasn't very effective. Well, this world and what's going on in it has really forced us to work a lot closer together. Do you want to speak to that comment, Steve?
Yeah, I think when you say EMS providers, is a lot of different people. I was in Canton, Ohio the other day, and I saw some Canton Fire Department medics wearing vests, and they were all military looking. That's one type of paramedic service where, you know, they're ready and they're compensated if something happens. I think by and large, most people in EMS are volunteer and private, and they don't get the compensation if they get severely injured or killed. But I don't think any EMS person should go in during a shooting unless they've been working with the police as part of a team. Like beforehand, like you guys said, that's prudent, you know. I personally always felt, even working in the Bronx, like, look at this shooting going on. I as a paramedic, really don't belong there. That was always my mindset. I realize times have changed and there's more training available, but that's how I looked at it. You know, my job was to deliver medical care and not to go running into a crime in progress. But
like the other gentleman said,
sometimes we're there when it happens, and these are our friends and coworkers. But I think you always gain by talking about these things ahead of time. And like I said in the article, talk to your partner. I work with a guy who told me, he goes, look, if anything really happens and we get separated in this high rise, you meet me in the lobby of the second floor. That's where we rally up. I'm like, oh, that's a good idea. It's good to talk about these things and have the training beforehand. I personally don't think EMS people should go into an active shooter. I mean, unless they've been working with the police and the special weapons teams ahead of time, you know?
Well, and that's the point. Never would we. I mean, you know, for so many years, we were always in the cold zone. You don't get out of the cold zone until you never go out of the cold zone. They will bring patients to you. But we found out in some cases that was too late. We never want to go into a hot zone. We never go into a situation where there's obviously active shooter. The warm zone is a situation where it appears to be, to the best of the ability of the cops to do it, it appears to be mitigated. But there's always that what if. There, maybe there's another shooter they didn't know about. So there's a potential for more danger. You couldn't call it a cold zone, which is absolutely 100% safe. It's just not 100% safe. So just to clarify for the listeners, we're never talking about putting EMSers or anybody else into a situation where there's, you know, active shooting going on. That's never going to happen. It should never happen, regardless of your level of training, unless you happen to be a tactical medic and are training with that specific SWAT team. That's a whole different scenario.
Just another thought on this subject with the recent advent of the war overseas and the amount of veterans getting out who were or who are combat medics. The mentality, I think, and being a veteran, I know my reaction is to run toward the gunfire because I'm stupid. But the mentality of these former combat medics or guys getting out of the military who are in a medical role and are used to being in combat, I wonder how their perspective could be different than civilian.
I think you make a good point, Kevin, and you know, there's a lot to be said for, you know, the level of experience that you bring to any EMS job, especially when you have that prior military background, or as in BJ's case, prior police background. It changes your perspective on what your comfort level is with doing certain things, and not that you'd ever be comfortable in that situation, but I guess maybe the uncomfort level. But you know, there's exactly something to be said for that.
Yeah, because I think it was passed a bill to expedite service members leaving the military to get their EMT on the civilian side a lot easier if they didn't have it. And I don't know the bill number, but I know I was at a meeting with an EMT at one of the conferences a number of years ago where they were putting a big push on this, and it finally came to fruition. And
it depends on the specialized groups, too. In New Orleans, right, the pararescue guys from the Air Force used to come and train and actually get their paramedic before they left the city to go back to active duty.
And you have, you know, special forces medics who are pretty much PAs. You got your PJs. You have just varying degrees of medics depending on their branch of service and what their actual job is. But somebody who's been in the past 10 years and is now getting out and transitioning into the civilian side of things, the mentality behind the way they're used to doing medicine, I think, is a whole lot different than the average civilian medic or EMT, where they're always getting told, you know, stay in the cold zone, stay away, whereas the veteran coming out saying, if you can take out the threat, and I've had the training, and this is what I did, you know, game on. I think it's just a unique perspective in those individuals.
Well, and it's a unique perspective between the three of you, because here you have Steve, who definitely doesn't feel comfortable in any kind of situation like that. But you having been military and BJ having been a cop, you kind of think about it differently. You have more of an inclination to run into those situations because you've had that specific training. And I hear what you're saying about military, because they're used to, you do whatever you got to do to mitigate a situation. And now they're kind of bound by protocols that may not be terribly comfortable for them. But I'm glad to hear that they are at least addressing their training when they come back in the civilian world. That's a good thing.
Yeah, I was glad to read that. That had to be about 3 or 4 years ago. I think it was out in Vegas.
That goes hand in hand with a lot of local community college programs and state education programs, where they are, you know, facilitating bridge classes to take people from their military combat medic training over to, you know, give them the additional medical basis to go along with their existing trauma training to bring them up to par with a paramedic or something, some other level of civilian EMS.
Exactly. So, Steve, I want you to address this. You make the comment, it feels like the war is here in the streets of our country. Actually, there is war in our city streets. We live in a different world now. And you refer to an incident in the Bronx in the summer of 1988, where you were understaffed and short on vehicles. People were waiting an hour for an ambulance. The Daily News was covering that, and the public was really kind of pissed off. You got a lot of criticism and a lot of anger. So that was long before any of this current stuff was going on. How did you guys handle that?
Well, in 1988, we were in the New York City Health and Hospitals, and we were considered like the 16th Department of Health and Hospitals. So whenever they wanted to cut something, they would stop buying ambulances. They wouldn't touch Bellevue or Elmhurst. So they hadn't bought ambulances in a few years. And you can look in the newspaper, and the writers would go up on the Long Island Expressway and count how many ambulances were off service at our headquarters, because there was a known number of ambulances. So it was, in all seriousness, people were waiting about an hour for an ambulance, no matter what was wrong. So we ended up working off the police radio for the really true emergent problems. And the same thing happened. I was sitting with my partner, and he goes, what the hell are we doing? Why are we bothering? And I think one of my gifts is to be able to get insight and focus in a situation. And I said, Don, I said, this is our job. We have to go out and do this. And everyone's pissed off. The public hates us. The public right now hates public servants. They see us as the same as cops. But you know what? We go out there. And I think EMS always leads the way to change. And by us being the people that we are and listening to them, you know, showing respect and giving them a chance to vent and say, okay, I understand what you're experiencing is real. But let's focus on the fact that your daughter's having an asthma attack or this kid's been run over by a car on the street. And we can show the public that, you know, to the people we meet, we are EMS and public service, and we can show, you know, we should show good faith to begin to win them back. I mean, summer's coming to an end. This isn't going to go on forever. So I think by any article I talk about demonstrating respect all the time, see the person, not their actions or the words, what are they going through? Listening skills, reflect back to them what they're saying. And focus them to, you know, appreciate what they're saying. Look them in the eye, acknowledge that they have a real gripe. But right now, we need to take care of this patient. And I think person by person, incident by incident, we can win people back. I think that's our role right now, to keep our eyes and ears open. And always change your routine when you're responding. If you go into a central booking or a prison or a big shopping mall, use different entrances, use different routines. And always be listening to police and fire radio. Get all your information. But I think for the short term, we can be the solution of how to win these people back and show our true professional caring.
Yeah, I want to go into those safety issues in a minute because you mentioned those. But your comment on this was, during the tough times, we stayed the course by being tough and doing our job, kept focused and did our job. We learned to diffuse anger and focus people on the problem at hand, which is exactly what you're talking about. By concentrating on our job at hand, our safety, and persevering in tough times, we can provide emergency care and feel good about the impact we're having on the public. We are in public service to those we meet. Make the difference by being the buffer. We can diffuse tensions and attitudes by being the buffer, acknowledging their concerns, and getting them to focus on the matter at hand. And that's what you were talking about. What are your thoughts on that, BJ?
It's such a delicate balance everywhere we go. It's so true that that's what we see all the time. One of the big pushes that I've been working on lately now is not to focus as much on some of these major, obviously horrible, traumatic events, that they're much fewer than some of the other things that we're seeing, that things go wrong every day. And what was the comment? Summer's coming to an end. There's no doubt it seems that summer where everybody loses their minds a little more than others. And just everyday little calls we go on, that our compassion, our ability to talk to people and understand what they're going through can make a lot of steps and change a lot of ways on how people address us.
And I think his main point is, you've got to deal with every situation and that person and that family. You got to push everything else aside. And we have to deal with that person's particular emergency and make them understand that that's what we're here to do. None of the rest of it is important at that moment in time. Would you agree, Kevin?
Yeah, and I'm going to look at it from the small town perspective. That's what I had the most experience with. You also have the exact opposite. People read in the paper about these tragedies that happen against public services, public servants, and there's a bigger outflow of compassion toward us from the people that we care for. So it's not, you know, everyone you meet is going to kill you. In smaller towns where things like this, I'm not going to say never happen, but the probability is really low. The citizens are not all against us either. There's a lot of people who are for firefighters, EMS, and police, who will, you know, look at the citizens who went down to the police department and stood outside with rifles to protect them. They were citizens protecting the police.
Yeah.
I read that about a week ago, I think it was. So it's not everyone is against us, but the ones who are, that those are the unknowns and those we have to try and protect ourselves against. But don't get so paranoid thinking that, you know, don't get so caught up because of the few and think that it's everyone, because that's not true either.
No, of course not. What do you think, Jamie?
Well, I think that, you know, that's all excellent points. And I think it's about maintaining your perspective. You know, at the end of the day, 99.9% of the people we deal with on the street are just looking to get home to their family and want to be safe and want to be well and are worried about whatever their current problem is and need reassurance and need to feel safe. And we provide that. They aren't seeking to harm us. They aren't looking out for ways to cause us problems. And we need to remember that people are basically good. I mean, that's my belief anyway. So we can care for folks and do good in the world and get them to where they need to be to get their care that they need and then go back to our work.
Yeah.
And that's all we can do. There are going to be situations that are going to be unusual. And we talk here that these types of incidents are more likely to happen to the average responder out there than they ever were before. But that doesn't mean they're going to happen every day or every year or whatever. These are still probably once in a career incidents for a lot of people out there, if they happen at all. So the rest of your career is going to be pretty mundane, you know, nursing home calls and chest pain and asthma attacks and things like that. So don't blow all of this out of proportion.
Yeah, we don't want to scare off all our new EMTs that might be listening. But, you know, Steve does make a good point in general about situation awareness. And this doesn't mean, you know, you're really high-end incident like we've been discussing, but, you know, just on a day-to-day basis, you always should keep your eyes open, and that's the point that Steve makes. Stop, look, listen, and think. And he actually has a couple safety rules here that I'd like you guys to comment on. Stop, look, listen, and think. Communicate with PD and fire. Share information. That's a big one. Consider stopping down the block to evaluate the situation and wait for other responders. Remember to use hard cover to protect yourself. Examples would be a rock wall or a building, not a bush, thank you. Stay out of the line of sight of a shooter if one does happen to appear, and that can happen. And think big. Choose a distant location when staging vehicles and responders. And with ICS these days, that's generally what happens. If they know that there's a risk, they're not bringing an ambulance into it. They're going to have you staged until there's a safe place for you to go. And then they'll evaluate when and how that should happen. You want to comment on those, Steve?
Yeah, I think these are basic safety rules. When you talk about situational awareness, I actually remembered back to the Bronx when we were doing calls. And I remember walking into these apartment buildings that were these H-shaped apartment buildings. And we'd always look up to see what knucklehead was up on the fire escape or, you know, generally nobody was trying to do anything, but just be aware of what was above you. And another favorite of mine was going into the apartment, and you look behind the door, And there's generally always some kind of weapon, whether it be a bat or a machete or occasionally a shotgun. But I think, you know, we're taught how to do CPR and ventilate people, but I don't think we do a good job of really teaching people on the street how to be aware of all these little hazards and how to conduct themselves. You know, there must be a lot of new people in EMS.
But they
are. Situational awareness is really what it's about.
I can't agree more. And what you're talking about is New York is a very different place than Maryland or New Orleans or Texas. So what kind of things would you throw out from New Orleans, BJ?
Situational awareness is such a major issue that you got to have your head on a swivel. You've got to know what's going around you at all times. One of our big issues down here is you can't get that tunnel vision in on just the patient. It's real easy to do. I mean, when we do clinical work, we can kind of lock in on that ailment that we're dealing with and not see what's happening around us. But it's too volatile of a situation. Even in a place that's should be friendly, like the French Quarter, that's a lot of people moving around doing a lot of things. It's real easy for distraction and issues to happen that you don't want. So being aware of your surroundings in all levels, immediately with your patient, the people who are around you, and the general theme and things that are happening in and around you.
Absolutely. Anything you want to add, Kevin?
Yeah, I was taught when I first went through EMT school to always, you know, situational versus key. As you walk in, always have a secondary exit just in case something happened. And, you know, head on a swivel, I've been hearing that and saying that for years. And it shouldn't apply just when we're on the job either. That should be, you know, not walking around paranoid, but be aware all the time on the job and off the job.
I totally agree. Yeah. And Jamie, you come from a more rural environment when you're working EMS. So you have a yet again, different set of experiences.
Yeah. And, you know, just because you're in this inner city environment or a rural environment or wherever you may be, I'm a big proponent that scene safety is an ongoing situation that starts the minute you step into the ambulance and before the garage doors go up in the ambulance bay, and doesn't leave until you're back safely sitting in the bunk room or break room or wherever you are in your station, because it's an ongoing thing. That's your head on a swivel. The situational awareness doesn't end just because you have arrived. I think a lot of times people think, all right, the scene is safe. I can now let my guard down. Well, no, you can't. And that goes for being in a rural environment as well. There's plenty of yahoos out where I live that cause just as many problems sometimes. So you just have to be aware of that. So what I'd like to do, you know, I think is really just focus on helping people to understand that it's about training and it's about the way you train in your organization and the things you do. If you're going to learn to respond with your local police department, it's behooves you to bring in an organization or a training unit that can help train your entire system from top to bottom, from the hospital, from the health department, including the health department, including fire, police, EMS, local public safety of any kind, and bringing them all together and then doing a mass incident. And the people who do the best job of that are really, I think, Paragon Medical Education Group. They're our sponsors here at the podcast. We appreciate their ongoing support. But it's not just about them sponsoring the podcast. We really believe in the stuff they do. We really believe that their experiential training, where they bring people to you to teach you what they've learned the hard way. And that makes a difference. If you can hear something and learn something straight from the horse's mouth that's actually been tested and proven to work, or the experiences of somebody who's been there and done that, makes a huge amount of difference. And so it's not death by PowerPoint. It's active, involved drills and experiential learning situations so that you can get hands-on working side by side with the agencies that you will have to respond with for those situations. So check them out. You can go over to paragonmedicalgroup.com. They have a brand new website with lots of information, a great video that tells you what they do. There's also You can catch up with them on social media in various ways. Paragon Medical Education Group on Facebook. You can also find them on Paragon Med EDU on Twitter. But look them up and reach out to them and just ask them, what do we need to do to bring you into our system? And they'll help you walk through that process. They'll help you find ways to get that funded. If funding's an issue, they'll help you find ways to scale it to the proper level. But reach out to them, and while you're at it, make sure you tell them thanks for bringing the Disaster Podcast to you every week.
Absolutely. And the thing I love about them is we talked about, you know, we got the four of us, five of us from all across the country, and the regional differences are quite different. So that's one thing that Paragon's really good at doing, is looking at a specific system and really putting something together that meets the needs of that system. So just had to throw that out there.
Yeah, because if you've seen one EMS system, you know, the old adage, well, you've only seen one EMS system.
One, exactly.
In the United States, you know, we have all kinds of different organizations and different structures of organizations performing EMS service, whether it's volunteer, whether it's fire-based system, whether it's police-based EMS system. There are all kinds of different services out there, and every one of them has a different, unique process for managing and working together with their other public safety agencies. So, you know, that's one of the things Paragon does a great job with.
I would agree.
So let's go around and find out where we can find everybody. Steve, we'll start with you, because you really the reason we got this call together tonight. Tell us a little bit about where we can find you online, and a little bit about your book as well, because I think people who haven't read it should really get a chance to read it.
Thanks, Jamie. I appreciate that. It's very special to me. The Downwind Walk, when we're at Ground Zero, it was a ridiculous day. And at a certain point, you see the American flag and the Chicago Fire Department, Massachusetts State Police, Los Angeles USAR, and you realize, you know what, we're walking on the pages of history. And I really felt compelled to share the EMS story. And that's what it is. It's about EMS providers. And I'm very proud of the book. I've gotten a lot of good feedback on it. It's available through Amazon and also AuthorHouse.com, their bookstore. I have two blogs. One is ParamedicMastery.com, where I try to cover topics to help make medics and EMTs the best. Not the things you get in Refreshed or CME, but the things that you really need to know to be the best out there. I also have a blog, wordpress.downwindwalk.com, where I focus mostly on 9/11, the book, and September 11th issues. I'm easily available, stephencanarian@gmail.com, and medicmentor on Twitter. Actually, I'm very excited. I'm going to be speaking in San Diego September 6th and 7th at a local community college. So I'm kind of excited about that. You know, when I was writing this article, I said, oh, should I submit this to a magazine? I'm like, nah, I don't like being told what to write. And also, when you get on a blog and on a podcast like this, it's current. It's going on now, not 3-4 months from now, you know? So thank you for picking up my blog and sharing an interest in my book, The Downwind Walk. I'm currently working on a new book, too. Should be out by Christmas time. When it comes out, I'll share it with you guys.
Please do, awesome. And we can maybe have you on and do an episode, talk about what that is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would like to. And also, I'd like to make a motion that we all meet in New Orleans and walk the streets and practice situational awareness. That might be kind of interesting.
Does that involve alcohol at any level?
And in New Orleans, you can do that with a beer in your hand, right,
DJ? That's what I was going to say.
As long as it's a plastic cup, it's all good.
You got to do
it. That's what I'm saying, man. I've never been there. I'd like to help boost the economy, you know?
There you go. We'll have a great time down there.
BJ, how about you? Where can we find you?
Well, I'm at zephosbooks.net. That's Zephos books.net on Facebook and Twitter. How many shots did you hear? Or Zephos Books. Books are available at all the normal electronic and digital sites, Amazon, Nook, all that. Hopefully by the end of August, the second volume of short stories, the original one was Welcome to New Orleans. How many shots did you hear? This is Welcome to New Orleans. The life you save may take your own. It should be out by the end of this month and definitely in paperback by October for the conference.
Excellent. Well, we'll definitely do that.
And I'd like to second the motion and carry it. I'm happy to be the chauffeur and designated tour guide here in New Orleans.
Awesome.
Well, we're depending on that, BJ. I wouldn't go anywhere without you. New Orleans scares
us. And if you are going to be in New Orleans at EMS World Expo, I've offered BJ a space in our booth to kind of set up and have his books available. So he'll be doing some signings and be available in the EMS podcast studio. Sponsored by our good friends over at Physio Control. So we'll be there at the expo, and I'm looking forward to that. So looking forward to seeing you there, BJ.
So, definitely looking forward to it. We'll have a great time.
Yep. Kevin, how about you?
He hasn't written a book yet, but we got to work on that.
Well, BJ, just be careful what you offer, because I'm only 8 hours away from you, and I have a few days off every week, so I might just take a drive east.
Yay. Kevin, you would not be the first medic to end up on a couch at my house. Trust me.
Awesome. Well, people can find me at wildsafety.com, and there's links to all my social media profiles and such there, as well as my phone number. And you can email me anytime at training@wildsafety.com and find me here on the occasion at the Disaster Podcast.
And we might mention that Kevin had a great idea today, and he's actually putting up a Facebook page for the Disaster Podcast. And it never occurred to me that we didn't have one. So thank you for that, Kevin. And that's another place you can pop over and catch us.
Yep, it's a Facebook group, actually. So if you get over there and find it, and we'll have a link in the show notes, and we'll put it up on the website as well in general. But once you get there, just request to join the group, and we can have some discussions over there.
Yay.
Very nice.
Sam, how about you?
Well, my books aren't out yet, but maybe by September. You're giving me a motive here to have some books, because I know Jamie has a couple he hasn't talked about, but, what are you up to, number five now?
Fifth book will be out early September, definitely, in my Extreme Medical Services series. So that'll be out then, and I have another book. It's kind of a sideline story prequel that'll be out later in the year, probably end of October. So,
yeah, these are awesome. You got to read them. Anyway, you can find me in the usual social media places and now on our new Facebook page. But Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 at most of those places, and certainly on the disasterpodcast.com. And where do we find Jamie and Jamie's books?
Well, you can find my books at jamiedavisbooks.com, so you can look there. Of course, it's available on Amazon, Nook, Kobo, all those places. So if you look up Jamie Davis, you'll probably find them pretty easily. You can also find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media places, so look me up. And, of course, always at DisasterPodcast.com, where we bring you these episodes every single week to talk about all kinds of issues regarding disaster response of all types. And we want to hear back from you. So if you liked what you heard in this episode, if you have a comment, a question for one of our guests, please leave a comment on this episode. Right at the bottom of each episode, there's a place to leave a comment. And when you do that, we can get back to you and leave a response and have our guests come on and leave a response as well. So please get over there at disasterpodcast.com. And, Sam, I was thinking about, situational awareness and how EMS responds to these types of disasters. These situations are very different from what a lot of us trained to do originally.
Yeah, and, we need to rethink the definition of the word disaster, because it's not just earthquakes and hurricanes and that kind of thing. We kind of deal with disaster in our streets more and more often, and that's unfortunate. But it shows us, that's just another conversation, it shows us that disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.